Welcome to NWPB's StoryCorps special. I'm Sue Ann Ramella.
And I'm Shelley O'Quinn with the Novia Foundation.
Stories and storytelling is in our DNA. It's how we learn about life and, more importantly, about each other.
Today you'll hear from your Northwest friends and neighbors as they share personal stories about overcoming adversity, surviving against great odds, and how joy and laughter heals.
Shelley, your organization, Novia Foundation, works to improve, well, it's quite a list, access to education, health and well-being, supporting the arts and culture, create economic opportunity, enhance quality of life in Eastern Washington and North Idaho. That's quite a list.
And that is why we help to bring StoryCorps to the Northwest. And as the Community Foundation, we connect donor generosity to our region. It's about community giving back to and supporting community. And a part of community is people.
And people get to know each other through storytelling. And one story is from Larry Klott, and he helped lay the foundation for the Americans with Disabilities Act.
When I was 20, I broke my neck in an auto accident, and I became a quadriplegic. From the time I get up till the time I go to bed and get back up again, everything I do is a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's how I'm going to get my glass of water, how I'm going to make my own meal, how I'm going to get dressed. It's not a case of walking to the mailbox. It's a case of hoping that I don't slip on the ramp and slide off and end up tipping over. It's a case of, did the mail lady put the mail in such an angle I can't get it back out? And when I went through my rehabilitation, and what I was told is that someone in my condition may live a maximum of 15 years. But not to count on it. When 15 years had come around, that was when your mom got pregnant, and we were still thinking of the future. And I had two things I wanted to do after I broke my neck, and then I thought I'd probably die. And the first was to swim, and the second was to drive again. The university I started to go to said they would not offer a swim class for adaptive swimming. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get anyone at the pool that would go in with me. And so my wife knew some lifeguards, and they said, what's involved? And she said, well, you take him by his arms and his legs and throw him in, I guess. And so they did. Four people heave-hoed me into the pool, and I told them prior, let me go down to the bottom and see what happens. And so I went to the bottom, bumped, and came back up, and I floated. So I swam for maybe 5 years twice a week.
This was after the accident.
This was after my accident, yes. And we came out here and I saw hills. We don't have hills in North Dakota. It's all flat. And so I couldn't really wheel around. And then we were going to leave and work on my doctorate at a different university. And we got there. They claimed it was completely accessible except for four buildings, the four buildings I needed. So we came back to WSU, and at that point, I got called from the governor's office. They had started a new public law for the protection and advocacy of developmentally disabled individuals. Mm-hmm. And they wanted me to open up a east side of the state advocacy system. It meant advocating for more rights and disabilities. And I worked there for a couple of years, and then I started school again. And at that point, we were heavy into the lobbying for disability rights.
ADA.
ADA is what came of it. We eventually had to meet with George Bush because he changed his mind and wasn't going to sign it. We convinced him, and he did sign it. And he just didn't know that there were that many disabled people out there. And so anyway, that was my involvement with disability rights, and that never ends. It never ends because I serve on mayor's committees, governor's committees, presidential committees, all addressing issues of disability.
More work to be done all the time.
Well, we set the foundation.
Yeah.
That's a proud thing in my life. I'm most proud of my daughter, my granddaughter. And then after that, I'm probably most proud of the fact that my work and probably 20 other people primary in the United States pushed us to accepting disabilities. You didn't see a disabled person in public prior to my leaving the rehab.
Because you push the independence model, not the institutionalized model.
The medical model.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Never give up. When you think it's comfortable, you know you're doing something wrong.
There's a couple of things Larry Klotz said that really struck me is the independence model, and that you rarely saw those with disabilities in public. Do you remember going to school, Shelley, and seeing some of our disabled friends in class?
I do. And then I wonder, how did they get around? You know, we've had been on crutches, which I've had my fair share of, and I'm trying to maneuver on crutches or on the little scooter that they've given me. We suddenly realize the barriers that we put in front of people.
Which is a beautiful thing about storytelling and StoryCorps is bringing these issues up that we may never personally experience, and then we can see what life is like through somebody else's eyes. I'm so thankful that Larry Klotz helped to lay the foundation for the ADA, and he mentioned 20 others who were doing it well. That was very brave of them because they were putting themselves out there.
They were putting themselves out there. I love the comment he made at the end when he said, when we're comfortable, we're not doing the right thing. And it's so true. When we're comfortable, we're realizing that we're okay with the status quo. And the status quo is not okay. We have a responsibility to continue to make this world a better place. And that means being uncomfortable in everything that we're doing. So that we're always looking for how we can make it better for other people.
Yeah. And what if your disability isn't visible? How do we make the world a better place for those with brain injuries? The next story is from Jose Rehera and his friend Dobby Coleman. Jose had it all, and then it unraveled for him to the point where he was treated with electric compulsive therapy. He's an advocate for those with traumatic brain injuries and testified against the company that made the equipment.
Can you talk a little bit about what a traumatic brain injury is and how it impacts you currently?
I do think that most people have this perception that traumatic brain injuries are, for the most part, physical, right? Mine is an internal traumatic brain injury. It was caused by the sheer amount of electricity that was put through certain parts of my brain, which included 12 sessions of this electroconvulsive therapy. I'm operating at a high capacity with my God-given gifts, and then there's some gaps, you know, particularly as far as it relates to processing abilities, some motor skills. There's not the visual cue, but the damage is there. It is sometimes a little bit challenging, and you've seen that yourself being my mentor in school. There are some professors that I have to request some special time, and they will push back saying, well, I don't see where the damage is. I don't see a disability in you, Jose. And it's a very uncomfortable situation because it's a discussion that you shouldn't necessarily be having. The intent is good, that a professor is trying to be complimentary, but that they don't really understand. And I don't want to be in a situation where you have to explain to somebody saying, hey, listen, this is what happened. This is part of my past, because it does bias their assessment of you. In some subtle ways, not necessarily overt ways, but subtle ways, saying, well, he's different, or we have to exclude him. And I don't want that. I mean, I don't want to be excluded. I don't necessarily want to be giving special treatment, but I do require certain accommodations just to level the field, particularly in a very challenging program like the ones that you and I are pursuing.
Jose, I love that you talk about, you know, this invisible disability, because ultimately that's what you have. It's what I have, having a learning disability, and you with a TBI, is that we have what is referred to as invisible disabilities, but they are still very much there. And, you know, we notice them. Other people might not notice them all the time, but there is a lot of stigma surrounding invisible disabilities. But I think that's part of one reason you're such a strong advocate for other people with disabilities, but you're also such a strong self-advocate, and you know how to fight for yourself and fight for the accommodations that you need. So can you talk a little bit about your advocacy for other people with disabilities and yourself?
I was involved in a class action lawsuit against the manufacturers of the equipment. You know, I was unable to benefit from the end resolution, but it was the first time and the only time that a case involving damage caused by ECT, by electroconvulsive therapy, actually made it to the federal courts. And it opened the opportunities for a lot of other peoples who were frowned upon or they were discarded with blatant things. Because I was in rooms with some of my fellow, you know, TBI victims, and particularly the ones that came out of those treatments, and they were lobotomized. These people, they didn't know where they were. They didn't know what they couldn't even testify because they didn't have anything to say, right? I stood up, and then it's not only my duty to do so, but I think it's also a way for me to balance out the karma of sorts.
That's Jose Rivera and his mentor, Dobby Coleman. You're listening to NWPB's StoryCorps Northwest Special. I'm Sue Ann Ramella with Shelley O'Quinn. Now, our next story comes from Lewiston. Kim Neary experienced racism while in school. Her teacher, Charity Eglin, interviewed Kim about those moments and being a minority in Idaho.
I wanted to talk about what it's been like for you to be a minority in Lewiston, Idaho.
I don't have it as bad as the things I've read online. It's not saying that what I went through was good or acceptable. Mm-hmm. In my art class in junior year, a kid who sat next to me asked me if it was true that I ate dogs. Yeah, oh. And then I was so surprised, but I was a witty child, and I still am. So I said, no, I don't eat dogs, only cats. There's a lot of things people say about Americans, but I don't say it to their face. I think the worst thing I've experienced in high school or in Lewiston was when people threw food at my car. But I don't know if that was race driven or it was just because I drove past them. So,
well, yeah, because didn't that happen more than once?
Well, I noticed it happened once, but I don't know what they did when I wasn't there. I didn't even think about it in depth until that story about that girl getting food thrown at her car came out.
She had, wasn't it, the rope was tied to her car and they were, that was so messed up. That was some messed up stuff. So they threw stuff at you or at your car. I remember you didn't really think anything of it, and you told us about it in class, and you were just like, that's no big deal. And everyone else said, yes, it is. And you know what's amazing, though, Kim, is that that's how you take it, where you're just like, that's nothing, you know. You're just so confident. Like, when I think about everything that you were facing in the last couple of years, to me, you seem so brave.
Thank you.
What are your plans now that you've graduated from high school?
I've been admitted to the University of Idaho.
What are you going to study?
I'm majoring in political science with a minor in broadcasting. I'm thankful that I got to live in such a beautiful town as Lewiston, and I got to meet such great people. And thank you, Mrs. Eglin, for everything. When I first met you, you were already so open to helping me. And thank you for giving me like the outlets to express myself and helping me with other stuff I needed help with.
I want to thank you. And I've just never known anyone like you. And it's just been so cool. Like, I just love that you chose to be in my classroom.
If you're just joining us, this is the StoryCorps special on NWPB. I'm Sue Ann Ramella, and joining me is Shelley O'Quinn. You just heard a story from Kim Neary and Charity Eglin from Lewiston, Idaho. Shelley, that story is inspiring but also upsetting because Kim experienced some racism toward her, and yet she was able to partially not let it get to her. I had a chance to talk to her about it, and here's what she said. Kim, those experiences you shared about food that was thrown at your car and maybe some questions about what you ate, they didn't seem to bother you at the time.
When my mom and I were talking about moving to America, she always said that I had to be the one to adjust to the personalities that I would eventually meet here. So I just learned to be passive, and it's not good at all.
Why do you say it's not good?
Because as much as it would be great for things not to bother me at all, there are things that people say or do that should bother me because they are fundamentally wrong.
I honestly wondered if it had an effect on you.
It made me want to prove myself I also tell my friends that I love it when people underestimate me so that I can shine better, and that everything that happened after that, I just proved myself that even though, you know, I'm not American, not even a citizen, I'm a permanent resident, I strive to be better and excel.
Kim, what would you tell others who may look different or feel or live differently than those that they're surrounded by?
I would say live life as you want it to be. America is a great country of opportunities. You can't really take advantage of those opportunities if you don't be yourself. And it's a great country of diverse people with many different talents and skills. It would be great if you could add into the pool of great people.
Kim, what are you doing now? The interview ended with you possibly going to the University of Idaho. So what's going on with you now?
I am actually at the University of Idaho right now, looking out the great view of the tower, the Theophilus Tower.
Excellent. And how has school been?
School has been great. I got into college thinking I would be wanting to do political science or have a degree in it. But as I take classes and interact with more people, I've realized that my passion has always been with journalism. And I think Mrs. Eglund did a lot of encouraging in that part. And I think I'm going into broadcasting and digital media soon.
Shelley, it's often difficult when you have moments that you're faced with where you know something is said and not right, but then there are also some of us who things are said to us and we're perhaps conditioned not to be bothered by it.
That is so true. While I had the privilege of being born white and all the benefits that came with that, I am a woman, and I'm a woman who chose to run for public office. I had these experiences where I would be told that I was too young to run. I would be told that since I'm a female and I have children, that I shouldn't be running because I should be at home raising my children rather than serving my community. I received inappropriate comments, things that people would never say to my male counterparts in public office, but felt that it was okay to comment on my outfit or my makeup, or lack thereof, for those who know of me. And I think as women, we are conditioned to just let it go by us, mm-hmm. that we're gonna forge ahead in this world. We're not going to let that stop us. And I just love Kim's bubbly personality and her passion for just not letting the world and all of its comments stop her.
Yeah. And I appreciate her teacher, Charity Eglund, for being a mentor and talking to her about these issues, because sometimes we need somebody on the outside who's viewed what happened to let us know the context. And you were a Spokane County Commissioner, Republican candidate.
I was actually elected Spokane County Commissioner. And it's always amazing to me how often folks would hear someone say a comment to me and I wouldn't even flinch, wouldn't even faze me. And then they would come up and say, "That's not right." And I would encourage folks, step up and say that that's not right. We have a responsibility not to be passive in our behavior when we witness something said or an act done that's wrong in our community. Step up, be brave, do something about it.
Yeah, I agree. It's about being respectful. Can we all be respectful toward one another?
Absolutely.
Well, Shelley, this next story is a couple that I really respect because they went through so much together, and I could really feel and sense how difficult it was being a lesbian couple starting out, I believe, in the 60s. This is the story of Susan Little and Mary Ann Patson.
When I grew up, when I turned about 15 years old, I realized I was attracted to women, and I panicked. I ran as fast as I could, so that nobody would catch me as a lesbian in this town. I first went to Thailand, worked in a leprosy hospital about 1965. And then I went to Vietnam in 1970 during the war. And then I went to India for a short period of time. And then in 1985, I was fortunate and smart enough to go to Ethiopia. And that's when I met Mary Ann. But all these years, I have been what we refer to as holding balloons underwater. You're in a swimming pool and underwater on your feet. You're holding these balloons underwater and you're just hoping that one won't pop up. And that's the way it feels to be afraid that somebody will find out that you're gay. Mm-hmm. After 85, I finally relaxed. My life started about that time.
We wrote statements of commitment then and framed them and hung them on the wall because we knew we could never do anything public.
And since then,
9 years later, we had a public commitment ceremony. Yes.
In Portland, Oregon, 94.
Oh, we cannot forget the context of that. Oregon had just had this dreadful initiative on the ballot, Measure 9,
yeah.
That was harsh and punitive to gay and lesbian people. And the public conversations and the billboards and the ads were terrifying. And we decided we were going to have a public commitment ceremony and do our part to come out. I think we sent out about 100 letters to friends and family. Then we lost friends. We had people who say, I'm sorry. You can't do this. So.
But since then, we've had 4 ceremonies, 2 weddings.
2 weddings and no funerals.
We have a wall in our bedroom that's covered with plaques of certificates.
Well, we had to make sure that all these dark stories didn't come true, that you couldn't see each other in the hospital or you'd have your home taken away from you. So we said, man, we're going to get every certificate we can.
We had a civil union in Hawaii and a civil union in Vermont and a domestic partnership in Washington State. And then we finally had a wedding in Canada in 2013. That was pretty impressive. And then we got married, well, officially here in Washington, right?
And did times ever change?
Yeah.
And Washington had a measure on the ballot to allow gay marriage.
Right.
Now, I have to thank the folk on the west side for that, because over here on the east side, at the same time, we had an initiative to legalize pot. And in our county, our county voted against marriage equality, but in favor of pot.
Going to get married.
A ceremony. And our entire, as it turned out, the state voted for it too. Yeah. So
I remember thinking when I met you and had been with you for about 6 months, I said to myself, I'm just tired. Marianne gives me rest.
Oh.
There's no harsh sounds in this house. And that is a peaceful place to live. It's wonderful.
One of the things that I am grateful for, there is no one that I would rather have breakfast with and discuss the NPR news or whatever else. Your humor, your quirky outlook on life just really keeps me coming back every day and looking forward to the days.
What a great love story. I love all of the times that they have celebrated.
Particularly because they've been through so much to hide who they were. Like she said earlier in the story, running away basically from herself because society wouldn't allow her to be who she is and allow her to love who she wanted to love.
I did appreciate how they, as we made progress as a country, how they embraced each of those moments to celebrate them.
And this is the beauty of StoryCorps. People telling their personal stories so we can learn from them and expand our own experiences as human beings. Shelley is with Innovia Foundation, and they helped to bring StoryCorps Northwest here to Eastern Washington with NWPB. I'm Sue Ann Ramella, and you're listening to our StoryCorps special. Okay, now we go from marriage to babies. Dr. Kim Hartwig grew up in the small town of Lapway on the Nez Perce Reservation in Idaho. She's one of 3 doctors that serve the Mimi-Pu people. She tells her daughter Iris about going to medical school while pregnant.
So what was the story about why you wanted to be a doctor when you were 13?
My older sister was a phenomenal basketball player, and when she was 14, she blew out her ACL, her anterior cruciate ligament, which is a major ligament in her knee, doctors told her that it was going to be about a year and a half before she could come back to play. And when her cast was removed, all of her muscles had atrophied. She worked really hard with her therapist, and she put in a ton of work and lots of tears to be able to come back in 9 months. And she was as good as she was before she was injured. And I attributed her success to the doctor that repaired her ACL. And so I was going to be a doctor.
Where did you go to medical school?
I went to University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. University of Washington School of Medicine has what's called this WAMI program. The acronym is Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. Because Idaho doesn't have its own medical school, they reserve 20 seats for Idaho residents to matriculate into their class. And so I was one of 20 Idaho residents my year. And so we actually were at University of Idaho our first year of medical school.
When did you guys start thinking about having a family?
We didn't really think about having a family. We just had one. And actually, I found out I was pregnant with our first child my first week of medical school.
So how was that, like, that experience was like?
At first, when I found out, I was really afraid and scared because I had worked my whole life to become a doctor. And here I was my first week of medical school, and I found out I was pregnant. And I was like, oh my goodness, what does this mean? I can't continue on into medicine. Our WAMI director at the time, Dr. Laskowski, was very supportive and excited and said, we're going to have a WAMI baby. And I was like, okay. And he told me that there was one other student, actually, and she had a baby in medical school. And that was all that I needed to know, was that it had been done and then I could do it. And so I actually had our first daughter, Emma, in April of my first year of medical school. And class didn't end until end of June. And so for those 6 weeks, I did self-study, took my finals in August. And when I showed up to take my finals, some of my professors were surprised that I was there because I was a Native woman who was pregnant and had a baby. And they were like, oh, we didn't think you were going to come back. And I was like, well, I'm here. Can I have my test? And but we had 3 babies in medical school.
What else is something that's been really monumental in your life?
We were talking about this last night, actually, about how I was blessed with naivety. With all of the things that I have seen growing up on the reservation, with a lot of alcoholism and broken homes and poor relationships, one would think that my family upbringing was different because of what I've succeeded. And that's not true. I saw and experienced all of those same things. But I think that being naive and not believing that I couldn't attain a goal just because of those experiences. And I never once doubted that I would get there. And that could be viewed as naive in a lot of realms because medical school is very competitive. But so God really has blessed me with you know, that.
That was Dr. Kim Hartwig and daughter Iris Hartwig. This next story, I just want to warn our listeners, it deals with suicide. Allie Bretthauer interviewed her mother, Catherine Perus, about the suicides of her 2 sons. It is vulnerable and complicated.
So my perspective is that I was, you know, a preteen when Daniel died, and I was just a little piece of work. I was angry. I thought the world owed me something because my family was changing. You mentioned that you feel like you didn't handle the death of my brothers well, specifically like when Daniel completed. I don't think there is anything that you could have done to stop the pain, right? Or to make it easier. What is it that you think that you could have done differently?
I know that I withdrew from everybody. I wish I had made everybody go to some counseling like I did after Bobby died. I wish I had been able to give you more of what you needed during that time.
Having been so close to Bobby, I feel like I let him down.
Me too. I feel like I let both of them down. While I've processed a lot of that and it doesn't haunt me, the reality is, if you're a good parent, your kids are not supposed to be dead, much less by suicide. That's just, it's not supposed to be that way. Remember the poem you wrote for the tea party? It totally blindsided me with that whole thing. And I still read that poem when I do presentations, because it was so beautifully written, and it understood that most people don't want to die, they want the pain to end. Even at 12, you knew that.
This is why I wanted to interview you, Mom. You feel the feelings that a parent must feel when they lose a child. Your response was not to lay down and give up. Your response was to crawl and scrape yourself back into a place where you could function. But then even more, once you could stand, you started pulling others up with you. And so much of that giving, it feels like it comes from your place of healing. So not only is it vulnerable on your part, which is amazing, it's brave, but it's also tremendously generous. And you are my hero.
So I don't feel like a hero very much.
But are heroes supposed to feel like heroes?
I don't know.
With the isolation of COVID, we have seen a significant increase in suicides, especially youth suicides. And I think it's important as a community that we recognize that the impacts of COVID go far beyond what we see on TV with folks, you know, in the hospital. We also, through the isolation, have seen a significant increase in mental health issues and depression. As a society, as a community, have to come around and bring people together. And even if it's not in person, right, we have to figure out how to embrace our neighbors so that we can move past this loneliness that we're feeling as a society and as a community.
Thank you, Shelley, for those thoughts. I wholeheartedly agree. And so does Catherine. I had a chance to speak with the mother, and here's what she had to say. I want to talk to you about the current state of being. How has isolation and the pandemic affected people's mental health?
It's been a struggle. As a clinical mental health professional, I have seen a dramatic increase in anxiety. And I'm booked to max, and my wait list is 10 or 12 people long.
What would you say to parents who have kids or teenagers who are dealing with mental health issues and how they could help?
Listen to your kids. Pay attention. If it's a cry for attention, okay, well, then let's figure out why the child needs attention. And talk to them a lot.
Even if they resist?
Yes. Yes.
Talk to them.
And if you're concerned, then have your children go to counseling. When our second son died, everyone was now over the age of 18, all of our children. And sounds horrible, but I did it better the second time. And I guilted every one of my kids into counseling. And, you know, made them a deal. You know, you go for 6 or 8 weeks, and if you feel you're okay and your counselor feels you're okay, I'm happy. And I did get all of them to go, and most of them were fine because I do have a lot of children. But a couple of them did stay in counseling a little bit longer because they found it was helpful.
And what would you say to someone who feels they are struggling with mental health issues?
Reach out to a friend, reach out to a counselor, reach out to your physician. Yes, we're all full, but I know if I get a call from a doctor who's very concerned about somebody, I figure out a way to see that person. Mm. So you don't have to do it alone.
About self-harm, what are signs parents and friends should be looking for to help those that they love?
Well, watching for self-harm is, and it can range from anywhere. I've had teens that used an eraser and rubbed all their skin off. Oh. So it can be anything, any kind of an injury that piques your interest and you're like, what in the world is that from? You know, paying attention to your kids. You don't want to just blow off something that has attracted your attention. You want to pay attention to it and find out what's going on.
What are some things that someone could have said to you that would have helped you?
Probably to remember that it's one foot in front of the other. It's a very long process if you lose a child, much less if you lose a child to suicide. It is not going to go away in a few weeks or a few months. If you have a friend who has lost someone, let them talk to you about that person. Mm. Yes, it's hard. And yes, the person may cry, but they want to talk about their loved one. They want to tell the funny things and the sad things and all the things that swirl around in their brain. That was probably the loneliest time of my life, was the 2 years after my first son died, because I didn't feel that anybody understood and nobody wanted to talk about it. It was quite a while ago. So Daniel's been dead 23 years. It's much more open now, but it is still very uncomfortable for people to talk about and to watch their friend sob and cry. Mm. But it's very healthy for the person that's grieving. So just being there and encouraging that person and letting them talk, probably the biggest thing. If you are struggling in any way at all, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 800-273-8255. They also have a chat line that is the same. They have the first choice. Option one is for veterans.
You're listening to Northwest Public Broadcasting and the StoryCorps Special. I'm Sue Ann Ramella, and with me is Shelley O'Quinn. Now, earlier, you heard from Larry Klotz, a paraplegic who helped lay the groundwork for the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, as he was recovering from his accident, he met a mean nurse, and this story has a twist.
In one word, Dad, how would you describe your life?
Oh, my life has just been challenging. What I was told is that someone in my condition may live a maximum of 15 years, but not to count on it. I didn't live life like I only had a maximum of 15 years left. First, I set out to prove that I was more than just a guy in a wheelchair. After I realized that everyone that I knew didn't treat me any differently. A nurse would come in and the nurse would go over and always get ice cream cones or whatever. And mm-hmm. she'd say, what do you want, Larry? And I said, get me a pack of cigarettes. And she'd say, you know, you're not allowed to smoke. And I'd say, okay, then nothing. And one day she brought me a pack of cigarettes. And so that evening I was laying in bed and I thought, oh, I can have a cigarette. Mm-hmm. So I put my buzzer on to have someone come and light it. I heard this, what do you want? A little short, tiny woman was there at the foot of my bed. It was rude. And I said, I want you to light my cigarette. I don't play with matches. I don't play with fire. I worked in a burn unit. No. And she walked away. I put the light on two more times. Same thing. I pulled the light out of the wall, and it rang like a fire alarm in the hospital. And the nurses came running in, and they said, why won't you light a cigarette? And she said, well, I worked in a burn unit, da, 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 da. And they said, well, we'll light your cigarette. That's not a problem. And I said to her, I hate you. I hate you. I never want to see you again.
That worked out well for you.
Oh, that worked out really well. That weekend, that same lady came into my room and said, hi, how are you? And I said, get out of my room. Get out of my room. It turned out that she stopped up on the day my folks came for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And she said, where are you taking him? And they said, home. And my mom, not wanting anybody to be upset, said, well, do you want to come? And she said, well, I don't have Thanksgiving. I'm from Canada. Mm-hmm. And I sat there saying, no. And she said, yeah, I want to come back. She also came back at Christmas, and on New Year's Eve, she said, we might as well get married. We're going to get married anyway. And I said, okay, in a year, that's fine. And when we got back to the rehab, she said, I changed my mind. We're getting married in 6 weeks.
My mom.
That's your mom. If it hadn't been for her, I would have never made it this far.
Well, Shelley, what'd you think about that story?
6 weeks is fast.
We're getting married. And what I love about it is how you can at first think this person is just mean and terrible, and then you end up loving them.
And getting married. It's a great love story.
I know a little bit more about the daughter and the father. He used storytelling to tell his daughter the story of his life. And a lot of the stories were encouraging, because of his situation. But that really had an impact on his daughter. And so she invited him to do StoryCorps because others needed to hear his story too.
I also think it's beautiful how the nurse saw past his disability, and she saw past the accident, and she loved him for who he is. In our next story, we will hear from Robin Woods, stepdaughter of Evelyn Woods, as they explore the relationship between our current COVID situation and Evelyn's experience during World War II.
With the whole COVID thing and everybody having to isolate at home, I wanted to ask you, because we are so stressed out about having to live at home, and sometimes I think about what it was like for you to be hiding in an attic.
Oh, get a Kleenex, Robin.
I will. I had to work from home one day. We're really not even that much affected, but it made me think about, geez, at least I'm not in an attic. And I just wanted you to talk about it, what it was like to be hiding in Berlin in Germany as a Jewish person.
Well, it was all from the beginning. I was just born into all that. It was already underway when we finally were going to be deported. We had neighbors. My mother was teaching English to privately so they could immigrate to England, which never happened, to follow their son. They had made a decision to take us with them into their built-up attic because they had owned that building. The attic was like a small one-bedroom apartment, but it was dark in there, and we couldn't flush toilets, and we couldn't make noise, and we didn't have toys, and we didn't have anything to do all day.
When growing up, I always thought you had a funny sneeze.
You couldn't sneeze out. You know what I mean? You sneezed in because you might be heard. I did that for years and years, and then one day, much later, in the last maybe 15, 20 years, it just kind of fell out one day. And it's like being freed.
I went to the store and you can't get toilet paper or you can't get chicken. The food shortages, does it bring any of this back for you?
No, I think it's a piece of cake. I just think this is how the world is. And this is nothing. This is nothing. We were on food rations to that degree, like 1,400 calories, 1,200 calories for Jews, whereas for Germans it was 2,000 calories, you know. So it was all supposed to get people ready by demeaning them and spiritually making them cower and feel like less. I'm probably much more worried about what's going on with people of color. You know, what does this mean to them? And what if somebody gets into some other crazy hate mode? People always do. They don't learn anything. I had always thought in my life that the hardest thing to be on this earth would be to be a black person. To be a black person would be the hardest because you can't hide. You can't lie your way out of it. There's nothing you can do to appear different or to not be a black person, because I was able to be hidden because I had blonde hair and I had blue eyes and I was white.
Well, there's a lot of education about color going on right now with the Black Lives Matter movement, and having been a persecuted person, how is that hitting home with you?
Well, I was always grateful for blue eyes and blonde hair, and then I colored my hair for decades for that reason, because I could pass. It was maybe the way some Black people opted to pass if they could as white. You could fully understand why they would do that. I mean, the benefits seemed enormous in comparison to the indignities that would be heaped on you.
The piece that really stood out for me in this story was that through it all, she still felt like there were others that were worse off than her. And so despite the hardships that she experienced in life, she was always thinking that it could be worse.
What I picked up on from Evelyn Woods is the mothering and the parenting. She was aware of her trauma and how it affected the way she mothered, and here's what she has to say. Miss Evelyn, it's almost as if for a majority of your young life, you just had to watch people and not be able to talk.
Well, I just didn't participate, and I didn't ever believe that I had the right to a view or an opinion. Plus, I had a mother who survived, who was more German than the Germans. Jewish mothers in Germany could be like that. Yeah. That would be, if you're Catholic, more religious than the Pope. You weren't allowed to have an opinion. You weren't allowed to be heard. You weren't allowed to be anything. She was a very punitive person. I feel bad about saying these things about my mother. Oh. You know, she was a very brave and industrious and hardworking and smart. She was so overpowered by the events of what we had experienced, and not together, mind you. You know, I was in the orphanage by myself. I was with the rescuers by myself.
Did you ever explain your past to Robin so she could understand you?
Oh, absolutely, because in Richland, Washington, where we lived, Robin's teacher, when she was, I think, in the fourth grade or fifth grade, was reading, I don't know if they were reading Anne Frank, maybe, and she said, my mom lived in an attic for a time. And the teacher said, how was that? Why? So she explained, and the next thing I'm there giving a talk.
Miss Evelyn, what would you say to parents who have trauma? What do they need to be aware of about themselves, or what advice do you want to give them?
What could I advise them? You have to be open and communicate with the children, you know, at an honest level. Even if they're too young to understand it, they gradually will.
Shelley, Inovia Foundation does so much for the communities in Eastern Washington and Northern Idaho. How do stories combine in what you do with your foundation?
Stories connect us to each other. They help us understand a person's background and why they are who they are. And our life story makes us who we are. And the more that we can understand each other, the more likely we are to be nice to each other. And what a better world that would be, especially today.
Next is the story of a person who's working toward a better world at the University of Idaho, Dr. Sidney Freeman Jr. He shares his ideas on policy changes to support Black populations on college campuses with his friend Hannah Snyder.
You say you started the Progressive Black Caucus. What brought that about? What was the need you saw there?
I attended a historically Black college. One of the gaps I saw in student leadership was that there was a focus on kind of, you know, we can have better food in the calf, and we needed to improve, you know, housing and things of that nature. But there seemed to be a disconnect with regards to understanding the world outside of our college, particularly because it was also a Christian college. And so social issues, although they were spoken about, it was its own little bubble, right? We're Black students with Black leaders, with Black teachers, which was great in affirming us. However, sometimes they may not see some of, like, what we're seeing now when you're hearing about some of the killings that are happening with police and things of that nature related to unarmed Black men and things like that. Those things would happen, but we were kind of in a bubble because we're in kind of a self-contained college campus, Black-run environment. And so what the Progressive Black Caucus was charged with doing was making students aware of issues impacting the broader Black community.
What do you suggest when you're pushing for that? Like, what's your plan?
Yeah, so recently I wrote an article in the Diverse Issues in Higher Education about, yeah. I made 10 recommendations related to 10 concrete policy changes that predominantly white institutions could implement to support Black populations on their campus. And one of them was, instead of just talking about the need to hire Black faculty and staff, hire Black faculty and staff, provide scholarships for Black students, provide support for Black studies programs, develop a physical space or a center for Black studies and for Black students to congregate. Those are some things that I've recently been pushing for on our campus. And I'm actually seeing some of the work being picked up by other institutions across the country.
That's Dr. Sidney Freeman Jr. and Hannah Snyder.
What I picked up on that story was a comment he made at the end when he said, it's not just enough to talk about it, do it. Isn't that really a recipe for life? We can talk about something all day long, but if we never do it,
it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. It's the same thing for Inovia Foundation. When we rewrote our mission statement last year, we initially had the word inspire generosity, and then we thought, no, it's not enough to inspire. So our mission statement is to actually ignite generosity to transform lives and communities in our region. Because inspiring is great, but it takes action to make something happen.
Thank you, Dr. Sidney Freeman Jr. And thanks to Hannah Snyder for inviting him to talk on StoryCorps Northwest. The next story is from Colleen Mahoney and her daughter Nancy Mahoney. Colleen lives in Lewiston and is a civic advocate. She shares how her politics changed after witnessing discrimination.
Minidoka Japanese camp was about 16, 17 miles from where we lived, and it was the worst ever camp. There were big gaps in the boards. It was cold, really, really cold. It was horrible. They had to stand in line forever to go to the bathroom. It was intensive. I mean, it was cruelty, the way they were treated.
How did you know about that camp if they didn't go to your school?
Well, but some of the kids were allowed to go to the Methodist youth group. And the Methodist church has been very open, and they invited the high school kids and the junior high kids to come in to go to church. And then we met those kids. When the war was over, my dad was the first person in the area to hire a Japanese family. They came to the house. I still remember. They had two little kids. They came to the house, and we had a house out in the stockyard, kind of, that they could live in. And so they lived there until they were able to save enough to get their own ranch.
You were an amazing community volunteer. Part of what I remember that most impressed me was your work with human rights. I know there were other specific places and areas that were wake-up calls or...
Really?
Can you describe some of those?
Yes. I go to Salt Lake City, Utah as an adult with four kids. And the first thing I noticed when we drove over to the west side of this of Salt Lake City, it was all Black and Latino. And they were not living on the east side where the rest of us live. I learned then to become really cognizant of the fact that there was no fair housing, no equal housing in that community. So I became really, really, really liberal. I changed my politics. And then we all went to Oklahoma for a year.
And in Oklahoma, it was
Head Start. I worked with Head Start.
And what was that like?
Terrible. Because these little kids were living in just shacks. And you couldn't even get to their house because it was all gravel and dirt. We decided that we did not want to live in Oklahoma. And at that time, Senator Frank Church was senator in the state of Idaho, and we knew him. And we thought, well, you know, that'd be a good place to go. By this time, my husband had been a pretty good Republican. He had changed too, because he always cared about people. We both were passionate about everybody having an opportunity.
I think I was probably in high school, and you were chairperson of the Human Rights
mm-hmm.
Committee. Was that?
That was Nez Perce County, but there was an Idaho Human Rights Committee as well. Of course, that's all been done away with now. You know, they eliminated that. But nevertheless, to know that we are all the same. We may look a little different, but we're all the same.
I love it.
Just her story and her leadership is incredible.
Colleen Mahoney of Lewiston. A lot of depth there. A lot of change. She's seen so much with her own eyes. And at the core of everything, it's about treating people with respect and giving them basic needs in order for them to live their lives.
You know, as I was listening to this story, I was thinking, you know, we've set up internment camps throughout the history of this country out of fear. And it's the fear of the unknown and those who look different than us or have different backgrounds, who have different stories. And so as I'm reflecting on StoryCorps, I actually want to issue a challenge to our listeners to think, are you making yourself uncomfortable today? Because if you're not, you need to. Step outside your comfort zone and listen to someone's story. Ask someone today, what is their story? Someone who looks different from you, who has a different background from you. Do you even know your neighbor? If not, go ask them their story. It's going to be powerful.
An easy way to do that is just to ask a question. Perhaps you notice that your neighbor likes to garden, or maybe they have a pet, and that's what you start the conversation with. What is your dog's name? Oh, I have a cousin named Fred.
And so often it's actually just taking the time to stop and say hi.
I agree. And on the flip side of that, you have a story. Every one of us has stories to share that can help other people. My mother used to say that because I don't have a brother or sister, she prayed that I would have people in my life to help guide me. And they have, because they've told me about their mistakes and how they've overcome them. I have a richer life because of it. So I encourage you to share your stories with those who will listen and let them in on who you are.
And you never know who you may help.
Thank you so much for listening to Northwest Public Broadcasting's StoryCorps special. I'm Sue Ann Ramella, and I'm so thankful, Shelley O'Quinn, that you were with us today with Inovia Foundation.
It has been an honor. Inovia Foundation truly lives into igniting generosity to transform the lives and communities in this region, and we believe that through story, we can transform lives. Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who participated in StoryCorps Northwest last summer. Not all of the stories were featured, but they all make a difference because you shared your story. StoryCorps and StoryCorps Northwest is made possible with support from Inovia Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and NWPB members.